I honestly think it's in my bottom third of Marvel movies.
Oh yeah, I'd have to sit and think about. There's some.
I saw your list, JR. You're like where you put movies in the order, and I was like, wow, I really didn't like a lot of the Phase 4 movies.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to episode 340 of The Fascinating Podcast, a show about the fascinating people and events at the heart of our cultural conversations. I'm Kathy Kong.
I'm Matt Michalotis.
And I'm J.R. Forresteros. On this week's show, we are going to be talking with author Scott Poole about his new book, Dark Carnivals, which is all about horror and American Empire. But first, ooh. Matt, I know that you just kind of like blew through Election Day because you vote by mail or whatever.
Yeah,
but
my vote was already accepted by October 31st.
Is it real, though? Is it?
It's real. I checked it. It's accepted.
Kathy, you had a 16-hour day at the polls?
Yes, I did.
Tell us a little bit about that.
16 hours.
Were people allowed to bring you water?
Somebody sent me from Arizona, sent me coffee, which was delightful, and chocolate, which I did share. And and then Peter sent me lunch. Thank God for DoorDash.
Weren't just waiting in line, though, Kathy.
No, I was not waiting in line. I was an election judge, and I am what you call a ballot issue judge. So I make sure.
So you're looking at the signatures on the back of the envelopes, stuff like that?
No. So that's the people who check the voters in. I take a look at the little receipt that they hand me and make sure they get the right ballot for the right precinct.
So our
polling place, it's a small polling place, and we have 5-6 precincts, so different ballots for each precinct depending on whatever is going on in the election. So yeah, that's what I do, and it's a constant like correcting people's misunderstanding of what the process is like no, your name is not anywhere on this ballot unless you are running for office. No one can trace your name.
Oh, you like hand people a ballot and they're like, this isn't mine?
Well, no, they go, oh, so they give, sometimes they'll hand over the little receipt and they'll tell me their name. And I'll be like, oh, well, hi, so-and-so. But I don't need your name. I just need to know which number precinct you are so that I can just grab the right ballot. So gotcha, it's funny because I think that makes me wonder, like, do you forget? Do you forget what the voting process is like? Do you assume that we have like personalized ballots? Because you can't trace the ballot to the voter.
Do you know there, you can? Afterwards?
Not the specific piece of paper, no. Like I would never, yeah, we can't, I don't know. Nobody knows who.
Wait, how do you know what the what if they don't know their precinct when they come up to you? Do you have to look up their address or something?
The folks who greet them at voter services, ask them for their name, their address, and then signature. Their signature has to match the signature that we have on file. And then that record will tell you, oh, yes, you're at the right polling place. Oh, no, you're not. You should be at this place or that place.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So it was a long day, but it was great. There were a lot of people there. At times there was a line, like at one point there was a line about 30 people, which I've never seen in all the years I've done this. I've never seen that many people come in person to cast their ballots. And I can't help but wonder if some of it is around all the misinformation around voting by mail and dropping off your ballots and all that kind of stuff. A couple questions about the machines. And I'm like, yeah, that's above my pay grade. You'll have to ask the county clerk.
It's interesting, but down here in Texas, a ton of people voted early. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of people voted day of. And they predicted, which turned out to be true, a big split that mostly Democrats voted early. And because of all of that you were just talking about, mostly Republicans voted day of, which meant when the numbers started being counted, Democrats, like huge spike. So Beto, who was our running for governor against the very terrible governor who actively kills Texans with his policy, Greg Abbott, was way ahead. Beto was way ahead. And then as the day of votes counted, Abbott went past pretty quickly. So still Texans as a majority vote against their self-interest. So, and don't forget gerrymandering and voter suppression. So a lot of reasons that Greg Abbott won. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
We had an exciting moment. Our former House rep got removed in the primaries. She's a moderate Republican who'd been in for 10 years. Oh. And lost to an extreme right wing. He would call himself a American First Republican.
A Nazi.
He legitimately was saying, like, if you elect me, I will stop the wheels of government from running while Biden's in office, like things like that.
Mm-hmm. How is that America First?
Yeah, it's a great question. He's a veteran. His wife was killed in the withdrawal. She was also in the military. So he has this like heartbreaking story, good looking guy. He's like getting lots of traction. The person he's running against is a woman who's Democrat, but she's moderate Democrat. So she's pro-choice, but also pro-gun. And she lives off in the rural area. She owns a car repair shop. Her commercials were all like her chopping down trees with chainsaws, like this kind of stuff. And legitimately, if you look at any of the predictions, they were like, Joe Kent, the hardcore American First guy, will win. Like, I think 528 said 98% chance he'll win. And he did not. Marie won. And she, by like 5,000 votes or something, 4,000, 5,000 votes. Oof. So Joe still hasn't conceded. He said he will, but he's out there trying to get people to cure their ballots, which is where if there's an issue on your ballot, you have a chance, like, so your signature doesn't match when you mail it in.
Yep.
You can say, no, that was me, and, you know, fix it. And you have till November 20-something to do that. So he's like, there's enough votes there, so I'm not giving up till all the votes are gone. Meanwhile, everyone else is like moving ahead as Marie is the winner. But it's fascinating. My neighborhood, one of the Marie's supporters came by and knocked on my door, and I opened the door and she was standing far away with this really scared look on her face. And I said, oh, don't worry. I'm voting for Marie. And she was like, you are? Oh, she's like, this neighborhood's pretty rough. And I was like, you know, they're nice people. They're not going to hurt you. But yeah, I'd be surprised if you found many here. She was like, oh, okay. Thank you. And I was like, do you need to use the bathroom? Do you need a drink? Yeah. She's like, just talking to you has lifted my spirits. I was like, okay, have a great day.
It's rough out there. It is rough out there.
Yeah. She was like, do you want to put a sign in your yard? And she was like, no, I know that's probably not a good idea around here. I was like, okay. Yeah. I don't do signs in my yard, but thanks.
I do.
Do you?
Yeah, but I put Vaseline on them.
Oh, so people don't steal them?
Yeah, because we've had signs taken. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing.
So apparently the Democrats had a pretty historic midterm result so far, managed to hold on to control of the Senate, outside shot at control of the House, though that, you know, doesn't look likely at this point. Significantly different. It's pretty common for the president's party to suffer pretty big losses in the midterm, because our government is very efficient and effective. Any thoughts about anything that's been happening so far? Arizona's kind of a mess with their Trumpy election denying Carrie Lake having gotten defeated. Texas is still Texas. I don't know.
Carrie Lake got defeated?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I don't understand, like, so hypothetically, if she had won, how does that work when you are saying that the elections don't work?
Oh, no, Kathy.
It's only rigged if you lose. Yeah.
That's right. That's a common misunderstanding. Okay. Yeah.
That's what I thought, that it would be that simple. But in my mind, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. But okay, run with it. Go for it.
If you operate out of your gut instead of your brain, it actually feels exactly right.
Okay.
Right. I will say I respect that about Joe Kent, thus far, he hasn't said anything like that. He keeps saying that he will, you know, the will of the people is what matters. Mm. So I'm like, well, that's something at least. I feel like he legitimately believes it.
As of day of recording last night, former president, terrorist, and traitor to the United States, Donald Trump, has announced that he is running for president again, causing shocking. Many to wonder if we're going to invoke the 14th Amendment, which specifically prohibits those who have taken up arms against the United States from running for any elected office.
Really? People are saying that?
Yeah. So it will be interesting given the Congress's, you know, big circus that they did recently to showcase the events of January 6th and to lay the blame squarely on Trump's shoulders, if they will do anything with that to prevent him from running in 2024, or if they're just going to let this play out.
I thought it was interesting. I read an article about him making his announcement, and they said he made it to a room full of hundreds of people that included his family, advisors, and close supporters. And I was like, is that an indication that he knows that he has lost a lot of support? Because usually I'm shocked he wouldn't try to do it at a big rally, but maybe he can't really pull a big rally the way he wants to. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be.
Who knows? Well, and his daughter, Ivanka, came out with a statement.
Oh, what'd she
say?
Did
you say that? Did you see it? It's pretty much like, well, you know, this time through, I'm going to stay out of politics. I want to focus on my family and the privacy, blah, blah, blah. Which
really
is so fascinating, considering really the role that she sort of pretended to play in the last, you know, during her father's administration, and how public it was that this time around, it's, you know, nope, I'm not going to take a role. I'm going to be a mom. I'm going to focus on my family. You know, if you would honor that, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, sure. Okay.
Interesting.
So it's fascinating. All the talk about the economy, it's the economy and its role. I'm disappointed in the lack of depth and coverage and understanding that a woman's ability to choose when, if she is going to carry a pregnancy to term, have a child, how that is not connected to economics. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It kind of makes sense to me, but maybe that's just me and having had three children and how that impacted my salary.
Did those kids cost you any money or?
Oh, they were free. They were totally free.
Oh, they came
kids
free.
Kids were free. Yeah.
It's just a biological process. There's no money involved.
Yep. Yeah, it was between me, my husband, my doctor, and my government.
Your local government.
My local government.
Well, it will be interesting to see how all of this unfolds over the next 2 years, folks. But in all seriousness, we are, you know, we'll keep talking about this, obviously. And believe it or not, this has a lot to do with what we're talking about with Scott today, because his new book is all about the building of the American empire. So in case it's been a while, Scott hasn't been on since 2018. So in case you forgot how great Scott Poole is, he is a professor of history at the College of Charleston. He teaches and writes about horror and pop culture. His most recent book before Dark Carnivals is Wasteland, The Great War and the Origins of Modern Horror. And his previous books include the award-winning Monsters in America, which he also talks about in this episode, and a biography both of Vampyra, the Dark Goddess of Horror, and H.P. Lovecraft. He lives in Charleston, South Carolina. He is a great friend of the show, and we always love having him on. So let's head over to our interview with Scott. Our guest today is the one and only Scott Poole. Scott, welcome back to the Fascinating Podcast. Such an honor to have you back on.
I am so happy to be here. You all know that I love you and have always enjoyed my time with you in the past. So this is great. I hope I'm fascinating as you are.
we don't get return guests if we don't find them fascinating the first time around. You have one shot, then you're out.
I will say, Scott, we were some of us were discussing your book a couple weeks ago, and I think Kathy, you in particular. So the new book is called Dark Carnivals: Modern Horror and the Origins of the American Empire. And if I remember, Kathy, you said this is not what I expected.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it certainly was not. I opened it up and I was like, oh, this is the kind of book I would imagine would be on the syllabus of a really interesting poli-sci class, actually, or a sociology class, where you can kind of tie in not just pop culture, but culture with what's going on, not only in government, but like specific politics. So it was fascinating to me. So yeah, you make the list, Scott.
Well, thank you, Kathy. Yeah, thanks. I think that probably a number of readers were a little bit surprised by it. I think maybe especially if they had, I don't know, someone who read my biography of H.P. Lovecraft and then this, you know, they found it kind of a strange leap. I know that, you know, a few horror fans wanted some more horror movie exegesis, and I feel like there's plenty of that. It's just that maybe this is I don't know, what would you all say as readers? Is it simply more you know, assertive in its politics, clearly political? What do you think? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I am of the belief that everything is political.
Sure.
We just don't talk about it in those terms. And so right. I think that's why I actually really appreciated it. And I was rereading some of my notes and the timing of it too. This sentence, I forget which chapter, Death's Own Holiday, Halloween has become a multi-billion dollar affair that America has exported to other countries. Mm-hmm. And I read that. And then I think it was days later, the horrible incident in South Korea, in sure. Itaewon,
yeah.
around Halloween, and trying to explain to people how politics was involved in the development of that area in Korea.
Yeah.
And that
absolutely.
Halloween is exactly what you said. It was exported.
Yeah, it you know, like so many things, it came with South Korea's military bases,
right.
You know, which is one of the main and I think understudied ways that that American culture is exported. I mean, PX is all around the world. You know, families that find themselves living in Germany or South Korea or Riyadh or, you know, the other 100 and I believe it's 120 countries now.
Yes.
that the U.S. has some kind of presence. The book that is I thought of this as you brought that up. The book that is kind of an interesting companion piece along with this is the book Pulp Empire that came out last year. Deals with sort of the history of comic books and imperialism, and
oh, interesting.
It's a really good book, and it's sort of it's really interestingly parallels Dark Carnivals in a lot of ways. So I think this is maybe a thing that, you know, a lot of people are thinking about at the same time,
right? And not necessarily wanting to talk about their entertainment in that way. So I think,
right,
that's why when I picked up the book and JR was like, I don't want to, you know, say anything, just take a look. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing, because the way we look at particular genres of movies, and so horror is not necessarily one where people are like, yeah, this is about empire and politics.
Right.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right.
Scott, it's interesting.
Yeah,
the whole thing about America, the United States, is an empire trying to hide its imperial nature. Mm-hmm. I actually remember the conversation where I realized that America was an empire. I was like,
wow.
I was in my mid-20s. I was living in Asia, 9/11 had just happened. And I was sitting down with a student who was saying, like, I'm really sorry for the loss of life, but also you need to recognize that your empire is blah, 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 and you deserved a da, 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 da. And I was like, what? My empire? What are you talking about?
Right.
And he basically just said to me, like, what is an empire? And does your country match that description? And I couldn't come up with a definition that didn't match the United States. And I was like, oh, no, we are an empire. Like, I literally didn't know.
It's interesting. I think that in the last 20 years, it has become much more common for, I don't know if it's become more common for Americans in general to admit it, but I think that talking in those terms has been, has become, you know, much more common. Certainly it has, interestingly enough, among historians, you know, my brood, who you would think would be, you know, way ahead of the curve on these kinds of things. But American historians in particular, it's really been like, I would say, the last decade, maybe two decades, that that some of the things that I wrote about in Dark Carnivals cease to be sort of fringe, kind of conceptions. And it's interesting you bring up 9/11 with that, because I think some of the actions taken and how open some of those actions were, you know, as compared to the 1950s or 60s or 70s, is made people more aware of, you know, we may be a nation state that doesn't keep us from being an empire.
Why do you think we try to hide it?
I think that it is supposed to be, like so many things that are, absolutely intertwined in our history, it's supposed to be antithetical to this sort of original dream of America. We're not the empire. We're the rebels against an empire. We left an empire. And I think that the notions that I talk about in the book of, that you hear even on the left, in the center left, the sort of, you know, America is great because America is good, that kind of thing. I think it's very difficult to think of oneself in that fashion when you recognize the imperial nature of our actions around the world. So I think it's just, it's an uncomfortable thing to call oneself. I mean, we're taught of empire as a very, you know, as bad actors on the international stage, and obviously we don't want to be that.
So Scott, in the introduction to the book, you introduce two different now classic horror films, right? The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yes. And Jaws. Both came out in 76, and you offer them up as the chainsaw and the shark as two lenses by which we engage American empire. And I think that ties directly into what you were just talking about. So just before we dive into some specifics, can you kind of tell our listeners kind of what to expect from, you know, the shark and the chainsaw?
Yeah. So what I tried to do there was not so much to say that, you know, these are the only films, two films that are kind of the ultimate symbols, you know, and that there's this absolute clear dichotomy, but just to point out that an underground cult hit that then became, you know, kind of a mega hit, but still never really left, you know, behind its drive-in grindhouse roots, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There was something in that appealed to the American public at the moment that it was clear the U.S. had lost the Vietnam War. At the moment, the crimes of the Nixon administration were coming to light. That there was something that Americans saw, particularly in a film that was set, you know, very, very specifically in the West, the kind of original laboratory of American empire. And then there's this other side of going back to Kathy's point, you know, why don't we admit to these things? You know, we don't want to be the slaughterhouse on the Texas frontier. We want to be Amity Island, right?
We don't want to chase the tourists off the beach. Is that what you're saying?
We don't want to chase the tourists off the beach. And we want the threat to quite literally come from our borders, want it to come from the outside. And this actually makes, I think, the films, you know, kind of archetypal in interesting ways, both I would tell anybody listening, just go watch the last 10 minutes of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the last 10 minutes of Jaws, and tell me about the country that loved both these films. And so that's why I found them significant. And of course, it's also, this was almost a little accidental because I didn't really think about it until later. But, you know, then it's interesting that you get the weird mashup of the director of our Chainsaw film and our shark film in Poltergeist. And that feels like two different movies sometimes. Sometimes it's this very Spielbergian, you know, idea of evil from the outside being defeated. Sometimes it's the more Hooper-esque notion of, hey, this is America. This is even suburban America.
It's all Indian burial grounds.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the section of the chapter of the book called "Buried on Top of a What." Yeah, that's always the discussion. And I think as Colin Dickey pointed out in a great book called Ghostland that I would recommend to everybody, this idea of the, you know, something built on top of the haunted Indian burial ground. This is an American memory. This is an actual haunting of our history.
So since we just had an election, let's talk about a bit towards the end of the book as you're getting up into the current era that you call Ghost in the Machines. Right. So you turn to how the American empire has gone digital. And I thought this was so interesting. You compared our devices to classic haunted house stories. Yes. So in those stories, you know, the protagonist moves into a house, and typically that the dark history of the house is something they're not even aware of. Right. So is that true of our devices? You know, what are we ignoring or ignorant of, you know, as we use them?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting to me in part that the origins of online life and thus the origins of social media platforms and thus the origin of misinformation on social media platforms is in a forum that's original purpose was imperial. I mean, the internet really is born in the 1960s. People were at MIT and then at Berkeley, and as kind of part of the as a military project, it was sort of this, you know, the military academic complex that has been a very important part of the national security state since World War II. And so it was interesting then to me to trace that into the 1990s. And I'm not going to presume anybody's age, but I'll tell you, I'm old enough to recall, you know, the big switch when I was in graduate school to, hey, everybody's using email now. And at that moment, you know, if you can recall, and if your listeners can recall, that the language about online life was absolutely utopian. It was going to be the global village. It was going to be the information superhighway. You know, very 90s phrase. We know that's not the direction that it went in. And, you know, I think that is why over the last decade, we've had, I named a number in the book, but now there's really too many to count of sort of the, essentially the haunted social media platform, or the haunted app, or, some kind of encounter with evil on this new digital frontier. And I think that's a good way to put it, what you said regarding, often when our protagonists, when they move into the haunted house, they don't know its history. And I think that that's an excellent way to think about our often pretty scary online experiences that are both personal and therefore political.
It's so interesting because when the internet first kind of became mainstream, and we all referred to it as the World Wide Web.
Yes, or the net.
Yes, as if that was going to be good.
Yeah.
Right. And there were good things about being able to connect and have access to information. But I wonder, do you think we're choosing to ignore the realities of digital life?
Yes. I mean, we have and we do. One of the interesting things to me is that among the college students that I spend a lot of my time with, they are, on the one hand, I think much more and really understandably very, very suspicious about social media, even at the same time it has shaped their lives to such a degree that they also have this dream of becoming a social influencer. that's like their dream career job. And so, I mean, even among people who were born into a world where that we had this digital infrastructure and really in many ways suffered because of that, they still want to believe that it has some kind of promise, despite the fact that, we've got a lot of evidence that it's gone completely in the other direction.
I remember when email was first starting, my dad was first available generally.
Right.
My dad was a computer programmer and he told me anything you write down on email and send, just assume someone else is reading it. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's secure. It's blah, blah, blah. He's like, no. There are all these people that can access it. I was like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. but of course he did. And I think even today, people don't really recognize that. Like, if you write something down in your email, you should assume someone else will see it. Like, don't write things down that you don't feel good about being out there in the world somewhere.
Yeah. And I think that, it's extraordinary to me that we, and I include myself in this, just, decide to behave as if that is not the reality. When, we actually know that, since 2002, everybody from the NSA to the FBI has had very, very, very wide latitude with, so-called sneak and peek laws and warrantless digital searches and other kinds of capabilities, the PRISM program, that kind of thing, to essentially be able to read anything that we think, say, etc. And so much of what we think and say online actually is being hailed these sort of these metadata holding tanks that are at Fort Meade. And it's strange. It's almost like they used to talk about this in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But, it's almost like now, like, we all have an FBI file, essentially. Maybe nobody's bothering to look at it, but it's definitely there. And yet, if you're like me, I seldom give that very much thought. I mean, I think I do generally, like, we'll shoot off an email and, you know, I never really think to myself, well, who's going to read this? When the fact of the matter is, there's a good chance that, you know, something that we say or do could get us into some kind of trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, my kids love TikTok, which there's great evidence that the people who own TikTok don't intend good for all the people on TikTok. But it's kind of like, well, where am I going to get my cat videos, though? You know, so you're right. You're literally, you're like, I mean, I don't know. You got to pay for cat videos somehow.
Right. YouTube. Yeah,
really fascinating.
You can go to YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube. They're all good.
Right.
Well, like Twitter right now with Elon Musk, who is like behind closed doors, supposedly, it's all coming out within hours, saying things about how using our users' data. And I was like, oh, sure. No. Like, I know that Google's using my data, and I don't think anything of it. But when I'm like, Elon Musk has it, I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know if I trust that guy.
Right. So. And I mean, I think that that he's an example, an unfortunate example of the direction that we've taken. I mean, I think that what makes his purchase of Twitter so different is that, you know, it's not Microsoft buying Activision and Blizzard software. You know, it's right, not, you know, a purchase by Time Warner. It's the richest man in the world buying a large slice of popular culture instead of an island or a yacht, mm-hmm. and essentially setting himself up as an oligarch. One of the things that's so scary to me about the Elon Musk phenomena is that this is far, far too much like what's happened in countries like Hungary and the former Soviet Union, where technically speech is free.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the supporters of the government, the billionaires, the oligarchs that support the state own the entire media landscape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now they can say, you know, it's a free market landscape, you know, right. And by a certain definition, it is. I mean, it's not Orwellian, thought police control.
Yeah,
it's almost a scarier kind of control of our outlets for information. So, I mean, that's why we're getting films like, you know, Friend Request and Unfriended, mm-hmm. and Grim Cuddy, which is a good one that I saw recently that I thought critics were really mean to. I thought it was a lot better than they said. And also why we have these sort of mini panics breaking out over things like the Momo challenge, the blue whale challenge, etc. The older version of this being, of course, the panic over Slender Man. It's gauging, you know, very real world anxieties that we have.
Well, talking about anxieties and going back to elections, thinking about Russian interference in the 2016 elections as we move ahead for another 2-year cycle of the presidential elections. And what we were told was happening through electronic surveillance. Should we be concerned? Are we afraid of the wrong things? Are we ignoring what's really going on?
I think the interesting thing about our the discussion about election security, misinformation during elections, is that the United States actually has enormous offensive capability when it comes to cyber warfare. You know, one of the simple reasons that we have not had one of these kind of, take down the whole grid sort of attacks that Ukraine, for example, has been experiencing since 2012 is much for the same reason that there was brinkmanship during the Cold War over nuclear weapons. The response from the United States, from very specifically a lot of stuff that goes on at Fort Meade, the retaliation would be catastrophic. Having said that, what I think, and part of the reason the book, I think, focuses as much as it does on social media, is that really there was never any effort by Russian security forces that we know of to interfere really directly with the counting of votes.
Right.
The interference was in fake accounts on Facebook and fake accounts on Twitter and et cetera that presented themselves as, various American organizations, Second Amendment organizations, veterans organizations, pro-life
evangelical organizations,
organizations, et cetera. And, I think that is, and one of the things I include in the book is that the Vietnam Veterans of America did a pretty detailed investigation with their own membership and the ways that essentially Russian-controlled security platforms had attempted to reach out to them by saying, "Hey, we're a Vietnam veterans group. And, did you know that Hillary Clinton is a Satan worshiper and et cetera." And the people on the other side of the screen were, either in Macedonia or Moscow or Budapest, So, I think that's the ongoing danger. And this is why, somebody like Musk is either naive or a pretty bad actor himself, maybe a little bit of both, when he talks about being a free speech absolutist. Right. I mean, it's sort of ignores the entire context.
Right. And he's firing anyone that says anything negative about him in the company, right, privately or publicly.
Nice. That's so, right.
Yeah. Free speech right up until you say what I don't like, which is, yeah.
The opposite of free speech.
Not exactly right. Free speech. Yeah.
Well, it's his version.
Version. It's interesting to me, when you lay it out that way, Scott, right? It's like we unlocked the house and left the keys on the porch for the monster to let itself in and make itself at home. And, we set out a nice bowl of popcorn for it and said, please make yourself home. Can I get you something to drink?
Sure.
And then we're like, why are you killing me? Stop murdering me.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it, I guess maybe, watching ourselves and watching the American public, we are sort of the horror film audience just screaming, don't open the door, right? don't go in the basement. And suddenly we're in the middle of Barbarian, I think that's, I think that's why, stories that either deal with some kind of demonic or paranormal evil paranormal entity online or the very real and very scary possibilities of stalkers using of various kinds using online life is part of the reason why we see such a flood of those films.
Speaking of that, can we talk a little bit about true crime?
Sure.
Because it's interesting, and this is one of those things I don't know that I would have immediately made the connection, but a lot of horror scholars like yourself have been including true crime under the horror umbrella. Definitely. And, Netflix just put out their two big, The Watcher and The Dahmer Show, which I think are still in their top 10 in their streaming. So, can you comment a little bit on our fascination with true crime? Kathy, I think this was kind of one of the things you were wondering when we were talking about this, right?
Yeah. What's the fascination? And I also come at it as a former journalist, a former reporter, mm-hmm. and remember mm-hmm. getting contacted by some production company that was looking to do this kind of true crime story on a story that I had covered as a newspaper mm-hmm. reporter. And my whole family thought it would be a great idea for me to be a part of this. And I was like, okay. No, absolutely not.
Right.
And they were right. like, why not? And I said, it's horrible. It's, right. you know, these are murders and attempted yes. murders. And yes. yet somehow this has become entertainment. Why?
Yeah. You know, there's really two thoughts that I have, although I am pretty eager to hear what you all see here with the connections, because it's something that I'm still really thinking through. But, you know, one thing is I think that we should see this as not a sudden development,
yeah.
That it's part of this much longer trajectory. That really starts in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. I think that the sense that this fascination with crime, with essentially, I almost don't like the phrase true crime. I mean, I use it all the time, but you know, it's what we really want to hear about is the murder of innocence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what we want to put on display. And I think that it feels much more prevalent because of, online platforms, streaming, and the way that, you know, I think even those of us who have lived through, well, in my case, several different eras of technology, it just feels like it's the whole, you know, it's the atmosphere all around us. So I do think it's important to trace it back to Ann Rule and the fascination with Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy yes. And on through. However, I do think that maybe there's been a shift in the last 20 years or so coming out of the 1990s that is a very specific concern about the possibility of being entertained by crime mm-hmm. that at one and the same time you despise and fear enough that it affects the way that you vote. It's very interesting that, you know, this trajectory of growth and popularity also follows the trajectory of mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you know, the idea that emerged in the 90s, which was, you know, one of the most crime-free decades in American history, that in fact crime was everywhere. And that has become a continuing issue, so much so that in the last couple of years, when a completely expected uptick in crime has occurred, given the pandemic, given being on the verge of economic recession, et cetera, you know, suddenly there's this sense that crime is everywhere. And so, you know, part of my distaste, I guess I would call it, for true crime is that, you know, it puts people, you know, at the same time, we are the nation that incarcerates a larger percentage of its population than any country on earth, more than China, more than North Korea, more than Russia. We're also holding up these stories of violence that affect real people and saying, hey, we want to be entertained by that. And so I think that tells us something pretty scary about why we have the imperial mentality. I mean, it's something that's at home that then is projected abroad. It's not just something that the Pentagon is doing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In the 90s, I worked in a comic book shop
mm-hmm.
and this guy came in. And it wasn't like today, right? You can watch documentaries about serial killers very easily. There was like maybe an occasional one. This guy comes in and he wants to buy serial killer trading cards.
And I remember. Yeah.
So what he had no idea about is that my boss, the owner of the store, his sister was killed by a serial killer. And he came out and was furious and like threw the guy out. And I remember so vividly all of the workers, us sitting around and going like, what's wrong with that guy? So weird, man. Why does he want serial killer trading cards? And then come forward to today, and the number one show on Netflix is a dramatization of Jeffrey Dahmer, which is really fascinating. And to the point that my kids are telling me, who are in college, you know, that people are dressing up as Dahmer. They're copying the voice. They're saying weird things to each other in the voice. And I'm like, oh, man, that I feel like it's a sign of some sort of sickness, right? Something's spreading.
You know, and it's interesting to me. It's a little hard. I haven't gotten my own head around this. You know, how is it that I, who, you know, am a person who has seen Cannibal Holocaust twice. How is it that it's literally impossible for me to sit down and watch Monster, the Dahmer.
Yeah.
I just can't, you know, I can't bring myself to do that. And so I haven't figured it out really, but clearly, even though I think that, you know, part of the fascination with true crime is like the fascination with horror, there's also these very real differences. Obviously, that, you know, one, we're talking about fictional people and characters as opposed to you know, sort of being fascinated with the actual, you know, victims of crime. But there's more to it. I don't know.
So I wonder if there's something of the shark happening here, too, which you alluded to already when you talked about how, you know, it's these things sort of spike in times of relative societal calm. But I believe I should have looked this up before the show. I'm pretty sure that overwhelmingly the majority consumer of true crime is white women. And I think that's such an interesting thing because we also know about like domestic violence rates and the fact that women in particular are most likely to be harmed, not by a stranger, but by someone they know, someone in their home, someone in their family. And so it's interesting to me that given that reality, there's this sort of, I think it's like the Jaws sort of, this is where we want to live, right? Where the home is safe and the home is good. And the things that we're in danger from are these outside sources, you know, these crazy people and it's all mental health and blah, 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 you know. I don't know. Again, that's all very much from the hip, but I was just kind of sitting here thinking through the framework you give us in the book and, you know, what little I know about true crime.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So it's kind of like, you know, where we want to sit on the beach at Amity Island and watch the shark do its thing. That actually makes a lot of sense.
So I think by way of wrapping up, because I know we're running out of time, Dark Carnival has felt a lot to me like a sequel to Wasteland. Wasteland was your previous book, which was about sort of the origins of modern horror in World War One, and then this book very much picks up after World War One and develops the American Empire. What are you working on next? Like, where do you go from here?
Last time someone asked me what I was working on right after the book came out, I said myself.
Good answer. Yes.
And actually, I'm sort of going to stick with that answer. Dark Carnivals is important to me in part because it is, you're absolutely right. It is a kind of unofficial sequel to Wasteland. My press allow me to call it that, really, but that is what it is. And in fact, it's actually kind of the conclusion of this sort of unofficial trilogy of books, Monsters in America being the first. And anybody who has looked at all three of those, I think, will get a sense of what I did there. You know, so now, you know, I'm just, you know, hanging out.
Good for you. Well, let's switch over then. Instead of that, let's ask, since you're one of our favorite horror experts, what horror have you been enjoying lately? You mentioned Grim Cuddy, which I think is available on Hulu.
Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken.
And I would actually recommend it. The reviews haven't been that good, but I think they've been kind of unfair. I think that there was a feeling about it that a lot of reviewers said that it's too preachy when it comes to social media, and I didn't see that at all. But I do actually want to mention this little film that it would be easy to miss that I think is either on Shudder or Hulu or both, but it's relatively new. It has the not very promising name Ultrasound, which doesn't actually tell you anything about the the film. But it's extremely interesting. A director I had not heard of before, Joe Schroeder. I don't know what other kinds of work he has done. I think short films. But I came across it, was not very interested in it at first, gave it a watch. It's interesting, kind of a puzzle box movie, what's actually going on kind of film. You very much think it's one thing and then it's another. I was pleased to see that even though it's not very well known, it you know, critics have tended to kind of rave about it. It has a ton of positive reviews. So I think a lot of people missed it because of the title. It sounds like it's another sort of you know, pregnancy horror kind of thing, and it's not. It's actually going to be of interest to, I think, anybody who liked Dark Carnivals, because there's some allusions to the things like the MK Ultra program and other stuff. So that was a fun thing that I watched recently.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Scott Poole,
back into my Werewolf by Night collection.
yes. Well, Scott, it's always a pleasure to have you on. You are mainly, if I'm not mistaken, hanging out on Twitter these days. Is that correct?
I have actually left Twitter.
Oh, you're gone. Okay. Okay. So where would you like to direct folks who want to keep tabs on all of your latest work?
They should buy my books hopefully from an indie bookstore. It would be my request. I think that's the best way to keep up with me. Let's read my book.
Excellent. All right. Well, our guest today has been the inestimable Scott Poole. His latest book, Dark Carnivals, Modern Horror and the Origins of American Empire, are available anywhere books are sold. And Scott, again, thanks so much for being back with us. We look forward to having you back again in the future.
Thank you for having me.
All right, well, let's talk about what's been fascinating us this week. I will go first. I have one that is custom designed for fitting with this episode, talking about social media and horror. Mm-hmm. It is a movie that I know for sure you can watch on Shudder. I think you might be able to rent it elsewhere, but it is called Deadstream, as in a play on live stream. And it is a horror comedy that is about a YouTuber who got canceled for very legitimate reasons, like not being sarcastic here, like the guy is kind of a turd. And he's famous. He built his platform on viewers daring him to do things. So he's been remonetized. His suspension has been lifted. He's back. And to get his streaming audience back and to make his sponsors happy, he locks himself inside a haunted house for the night to see if he can make it all night in the haunted house. And of course, it turns out the house is actually haunted. And the movie, I think, works. It's genuinely scary in parts. It's also very, very funny. It works because this guy is a legitimate turd. Like, you don't feel that bad that everything is happening to him. Like, he kind of deserves it. But also, he's so pathetic once things start happening that you feel sorry for him. So you're able to, like, empathize with him, but then be like, well, I don't feel that bad for him. And you get, so you can kind of enjoy watching him, like, deal with the malicious, malevolent presences.
It's like comedy horror, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, definitely legitimately some scary parts in the movie, but overall, mostly comedy. So yeah, it's, nice. It's really fun. I watched it, enjoyed it quite a lot, made Amanda watch it and she enjoyed it quite a lot, and then have recommended it to several people since then who have, universally pretty much enjoyed it. So Deadstream.
That's awesome.
Great movie. Yeah. Kathy, what do you have?
So I am listening to an audiobook, and this is my third try. So listeners, I don't know if you are the kind of person like starts a book, and if it doesn't capture you in like the first couple of pages, you give up and you don't return. I am one who's like, maybe I'm just not in the right mood or the right headspace. Or so I give books a try. And this one, the first time I remember, I just did not have time to like sit down with the physical book, and then I couldn't renew it. And then the second time it was on audio, and then it was the same thing. Like I forgot I had it in my queue, had started it, and then came back to it and was like, I don't remember. And now third try, The School for Good Mothers by Jessamine Chan. It is haunting and a little disturbing, and I'm about a fourth of the way through. And I find myself wanting to take walks outside, even though it's 34 degrees, so that I can listen to it. And it is about a mom who is divorced, trying to share custody of her daughter, and can't. She has a bad day. And then the state takes over, takes away custody, puts her in this kind of good mom training program. And part of it is listening to it. And I think if I were the mother of young children, it probably would put me into a state of anxiety. Mm-hmm. But I am two decades away from it. And I'm listening to this. And I think we do this to moms now. And this is fiction. Mm-hmm. So listen to it or read it. The School for Good Mothers.
Nice.
That sounds great. I'm glad you gave it a third chance.
Yeah, I am too. Thankful for the public library.
Oh, well, my right, choice is, it's not horrific at all. So it's a bad fit for this episode. Micah and I every night try to watch a couple cartoons together. It's like we relax and chill on the couch and watch a couple shows together. We've gone through like all sorts of shows like Star versus the Forces of Evil and like entire seasons, right? And last week we were like, we need a new cartoon. We've run out of these. And so I dug up an old show that I remember people like obsessing over that I had never watched before called Adventure Time, which have you guys seen this show?
Have not. But again, I know a lot of people love it.
It is the weirdest, like dumbest, grossest, funniest show that I've watched in a long time. It's about this little boy who's like 12. Named Finn, who lives in this weird land with like monsters and aliens and giants and people made out of sugar and whatever. And his best friend is a dog named Jake that can like grow giant sizes and change shapes and stuff. And it's literally just their adventurers. And so every episode they're like going on an adventure. And sometimes it's really stupid stuff like all the sugar people are coming back to life as zombies and want to eat sugar. Sometimes it's stuff like they find a little animal on the side of the road, like just goofing around. They take it home and realize they kidnapped it on accident from its mother. And now it's dying. And they're like, oh, my gosh, we're kidnappers and murderers. So it's ridiculous. It's so funny. And like I laugh much harder than Micah. I'm laughing really hard sometimes. She's looking over like, are you okay? I'm like, that is really funny. And it's terrible. It's a 12-year-old boy. He's terrible in multiple ways. But yeah, the episode we just watched is they live in this treehouse and a vampire comes and is like, hey, this is my treehouse. I built it 1,000 years ago. Get out of here. And they're like, no way. And but they're scared of the vampire, so they leave. And it's just them sad looking for a house the rest of the episode.
Fantastic.
It. Anyway, fantastic. It's amazing. Adventure Time.
Where they go. Adventure Time. All right. Yeah,
Hulu. It's on Hulu.
So I understand you two are selecting a book cover. Is that the buzz on the
street?
Oh
my gosh, we're supposed to turn it in by tomorrow and I have no idea. I haven't even looked at it.
Yeah.
What else do y'all have cooking that you can talk about?
We're editing that book as well.
That's about it. If listeners could see the looks of resignated sadness on the faces of these two right now.
Yeah, the book, the book edits are due December 2nd, and I'm maybe half through what I need to do. So I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, you're more than there. You're further than I am.
Well, by the time this episode goes up, I should have an article up at Think Christian on Quantum, the new Quantum Leap show's Halloween episode, which was their take on The Exorcist. Ooh. And so Ben, the atheist quantum physicist, leaps into a Catholic priest who has been brought to a house to perform an exorcism. It's a great setup. I enjoyed the episode a lot. And of course, it's a classic kind of faith versus science sort of episode that I had a lot of fun with. So I wrote about it for TC. So you can head over there.
That's awesome.
And check it out. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. This has been episode 340. On next week's episode, we're talking about Wakanda Forever. Kathy, tell us a little bit about our guest we're going to have with us.
Keisha Polonio, who is a licensed therapist, artist, just amazing person. And I just thought it would be interesting to bring her in. So spoiler alert, if you have not watched the movie, there is a theme in there about grief.
Was there really?
Yeah. So I thought it'd be interesting to bring somebody who loved the movie, but also could talk a little bit about grief and talk about the movie. So
great. Look forward to people talking with people who actually enjoyed the movie.
I haven't seen it yet,
sure did not. no, I'm legitimate. I wasn't being sarcastic. I'm legitimately excited to hear it from people who enjoyed the film. So that's next week. For now, make sure you pick up Scott's book. It's terrific. And take care of yourselves out there. We'll see you next week.